Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt. And that's right, the day has come. It is now time for Joel's Money Origin Story.
That's right, buddy. Today on the show, it's all about me.
All about you this time.
Hip, hip, hooray. No, I'm looking forward to a chat and kind of diving into some of my money backstory. We got to tackle yours last week, and it was a lot of fun. I learned a little bit. I hope our listeners learned a lot. And yeah, this week, it's my turn in the hot seat.
Does everything feel backwards? Because I kind of announced the actual title of this episode. You brought us back from the break with the music.
Feels like left is right and up is down.
Exactly. Which makes me think of those bicycles where, like, they're engineered so that if you steer left, it actually goes right. Have you seen these things?
I think
it's
I've
like
seen
a
video or two.
Mind cluster where like you literally can't ride it, and it takes, I don't know, like tons of practice.
I think it would take a long time to retrain your brain.
Exactly,
to do
that. Because once you've been doing something for so long, it feels really awkward sometimes. And
even just a small thing
maybe
like
this does.
Who
a little
introduces
bit.
The podcast episode? Yes. But before we get to my money story, and yeah, there's a lot I think we're gonna cover. I don't know. I mean, it's up to you. So we'll see where it goes.
Okay.
But I wanted to mention one thing quickly that. One of my friends, his name is Brennan. He goes by the moniker Budget Dog Instagram
like
and Twitter. Yeah,
I like that a lot.
I asked him how he got that name, and he was like sitting there with his dog while he came up with it. So it just like really
like,
was.
I like budgets. And I like dogs.
Yep, exactly. So he's a good dude, and he's doing a lot of great work out
only
there
if he
on the internet.
With a DAWG.
Sadly, no.
Yeah,
he did not.
You know, that's how it goes.
But he mentioned the other day on Twitter, and I had not heard of this company before, a company to help you roll over your old 401k, and it's called Capitalize. And I looked into this because I was like, all right. Brennan knows what he's talking about. What is this thing? And it is this cool. It's actually Capitalized was named one of Time's top inventions for 2021.
Ooh.
And it is this site where you get to go roll over your 401k for free into an IRA. And there are a whole lot of reasons to do this. Like, we could get into all the nuance. We're not going to, because that's not what this episode is about. But we'll link to it in the show notes. And it's just one of those
cool
things.
Site.
Yeah, if you have an old retirement account sitting somewhere else and you want to move it to a place with lower fees and better fund options, a place like Capitalize is going to help you do that. They're going to handle the paperwork, which is, like, for me, the most annoying part usually.
Right.
And so, yeah, it seems like this cool new service, and I wanted to mention it. We'll again put a link to the show notes. And yeah, if you're one of those people who's like dreading doing the annoying intricacies of personal finance, something as dorky as, you know, rolling an account over from a 401k into a new IRA.
Very technical.
Yes, yeah, but ultimately not that hard, but Capitalized makes it even easier.
And also, first world problems, right? Like, are you over here, Joel, complaining that you've got too many 401ks from previous employers that you have to keep up with? Oh, what a hard life that is.
No,
coming
but
from somebody who's never had a 401k.
Right. But we do say
recently.
Simplification is a huge part of making personal finances better for people. And if this helps you simplify things, combine everything into accounts with fewer companies, and also
I
reducing
totally get it.
That drag of fees at the same time, like, it's well your time to do this.
Yeah, if you're with a provider who does not give you the best investing options. You know, I will say, if you are able to maintain those accounts and if the investing options are equivalent or similar across the board, there's no magic to combining all of your accounts into a single giant account, right? You're going to earn the same types of returns. If you've got $100,000 that's spread across three accounts, the same returns that you'd see if all of that money was just in a singular account. But like you said, it's more of like a mental thing. And if that helps you as an individual, then go for it.
Yeah, as long as they're in the same fun choices, right?
Yeah.
For sure. So yeah, we'll link to it in the show notes. But Matt, let's mention the beer that we're having on this episode. We're drinking a beer called Woodland Pursuit. It's a New England IPA from the folks at Humble Forager. And I'm looking forward to drinking this one while we share my money origin story today.
That's right. And I picked this one out specially for you, and we'll talk about why, I guess, at the end of the episode.
Sounds good.
Well, like last Wednesday's episode, it's time for you listeners to really get to know us on a deeper level. Last week, you got to hear my money story and the experiences that impacted how it is that I view money. And now it's Joel's turn. Hailing from the Pacific Northwest, weighing in at like 180 pounds, maybe?
189.
Okay, 189. Also, you're the tallest half Norwegian, I know. But yeah, you were raised here in the South. My best friend, Joel Arsgaard, he might have been the cheapest guy I've ever met, which is why I think we immediately hit it off when we first met around a decade ago. I think it also helps a ton. Our wives hit it off as well.
True.
But I had never met anyone cheaper than me, and that's saying a lot. And it's no wonder that we were destined to start a personal finance podcast together. There truly is so much that I already know about you, but like any good story, you start at the beginning, and I realize that I don't know what your first money memory is, and so, yeah, do you have a clear moment when you grasped the concept of money? Also, did you always prefer the Kirkland Signature pizza, even as a toddler, or was that a more of an acquired taste?
Yeah, no, that was later in life, really. That was a more recent occurrence. And I will say, actually, I talked about this recently on Twitter with somebody, how Little Caesars raised the prices of their pizza.
That inflation, baby.
Inflation rubbers meet in the road. Mm-hmm. But life's too short to really eat cheap pizza too frequently. So I usually spring for the nicer stuff these days.
Right.
But yeah, I guess when it comes to first money memories, probably my first money memory is my parents had like this this cardboard cutout with like little dimes and nickels and pennies and dollars. Did you ever have one of those?
Where
it's
no.
Like it's like a little learning way to learn about money. And so I remember seeing that, and it was this tangible thing where I got to group them and do addition and subtraction and kind of get to figure out how money works.
Okay, I do remember doing that in elementary school.
I had like the same cardboard like clock to learn time and stuff.
Man,
so I don't know.
Your parents like stole it from the elementary school?
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, your older sister probably ganked it, and you got to take a look at it.
She was a bad one, you know. I learned a lot from that. So yeah, I think that was probably the most early memories I have is kind of playing with those physical cardboard cutout of money. But then I think
some kids had G.I. Joes. Joel had dollar bills on his shelf all lined up.
Yeah, not necessarily. No, I was not like groomed to be some sort of personal finance nerd. But I think the other thing that sticks out in my mind when I'm thinking about the earliest memories I have of like actual money was when my parents and I had to have conversations about, in particular, the shoes that I wanted to buy. I was like super into the fancy basketball shoes of the day, the Scottie Pippins, the Michael Jordans, all the good stuff, the Charles Barkleys. They all had great shoes, man.
Speaking of investments, if only you had gotten a couple pairs of those and never worn them, kept them in the box, you'd be a multimillionaire.
You were thousands at least, right? Yeah. So that's a good point. but yeah, there was always a conversation between my parents and I because they said, listen, here's the limit on what we're willing to spend for shoes for you. If you want, we can get you these like Reeboks and you're going to, and you can wear those. Mm-hmm. But if you want those nicer shoes, you're going to have to bring some of your own birthday or Christmas money to the table in order to make it happen. And that was the first time I think I realized trade-offs and how important trade-offs are when we're talking about personal finances.
Yeah.
And sometimes, occasionally, I did opt for the fancy shoes. I put my money where my mouth was, and I was like, this is worth it. And I still remember that pair of Scottie Pippins, and they were worth it.
They felt so good on your feet.
They were so good.
Yeah.
But most of the time, I opted to say, I don't know, I'm going to get the free shoes that mom and dad are going to buy me. But that's one of those, I think, first memories I had where it was like, I have a decision, and I have money that I can choose whether or not this is worth it or not to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I love what your parents did there as well, because essentially what they're doing is matching you, right? Like they're kind of meeting you. I don't know exactly how much they're willing to bring to the table, but the ability for them to kind of incentivize you to alter your spending, your behavior a little bit, because you could have taken that money and been like, yeah, I really want those shoes. And then you go blow the rest of the money on your Sega Dreamcast or whatever. I remember you buying from like a yard sale or something. But yeah, because I love when parents are able to mimic the different types of patterns and behaviors that we're going to encounter in real life.
Yes,
right?
Yeah.
And so I love that your parents did that. And I look forward to being able to do that with my kids. I'm sure you're looking forward to doing the same as our kids get older.
Oh, yeah.
So kind of moving along, you know, one of the things that I think is really impressive about you is the number of different jobs that I've heard you had while you were in high school. Like I only worked at the local golf course, but you had a quite varied work history. So yeah, tell us about that. And specifically, did you have a favorite job that you held?
Okay. So yeah, I had a bunch of different jobs growing up and some of them before the age where you're legally allowed to work, just stuff in the neighborhood like mowing lawns, right? And that was like literally my first introduction to making my own money, and that was empowering. And my dad was just a big help in helping me get that business off the ground, like had just a few yards in the neighborhood, and he was always willing to help me on a Saturday, which is huge. Like, mm-hmm. he wasn't just like, all right, go pound the pavement, son. He was like, I know he was dead tired from working all week, and he still came with me to mow those lawns.
That's
which
awesome.
Major props to my pops. But then at 14, the earliest age you could start working in the state of Georgia, I started working at Chick-fil-A. And right across the street from my high school is the easiest place to get to, so I could walk straight across and work for 3 hours before I would go home for the evening. And I still remember my starting wage, $5.15 an hour, which was the bare minimum you were allowed to get paid.
It's a far cry from what they're paying today.
But I think my favorite job overall in those years between, like, you know, growing up and then getting to college was working at the Eckerd Photo Lab.
Okay.
That was just like a fun job where I was like getting to interact with people who had just gone on vacation and they turned in their photos. And do people even still do that anymore? I don't think so. There's not a photo person.
Well, they do. I mean, they've got the printers, but you just send in, they don't bring in the rolls of film.
Exactly.
You know, they send it in from their phone.
But me, I was like manning the machine and changing tones. I got like an old school version of Photoshop. Yeah. And then I would get to talk to people about the photos I had seen.
Because you'd seen it and you kind of know who's about to walk into
the
store because you've been staring at pictures of them.
Yeah. I'm like, hey, Rome looked like it was fun, huh? How about it?
They're like, dude, stop being a creep. So that was a fun
one. I was trying
one.
Not to be the Robin Williams okay. from 1 Hour Photo, but
So you just enjoyed that. That was just it sounded like it was fun from a social standpoint.
Yeah.
And knowing you, obviously, that doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, just got the way I got to interact with people was probably the most fun part of that.
Did you ever have like a really amazing boss or manager who, I don't know, I feel that in the past when I look back to some of the different folks who influenced me, they were always really good teachers. And so for me, for whatever reason, that's something that would stand out to me is the ability to not just do the job and get some stuff done, but the ability to grow as an individual and to learn. I'm curious if you had some different jobs where you had an individual that stood out to you.
I feel like I've always been lucky to work for awesome people.
Really?
For the most part. Like, there are a couple of bosses I can point back to and be like, not my favorite. But for the most
part.
Maybe
the Chick-fil-A manager.
No, they were great, honestly. Yeah. And it's one of those situations where when you're 14, 15, and you're completely immature, you need someone who's going to give you like a whole lot of grace as they're kind of, you know, helping you grow up into an adult. And that was just a great learning experience for me, having a job early on.
That's good.
But yeah, I think the managers there were super helpful. And it was a great experience. I don't know, probably my favorite boss was at the radio station I worked at for like 14, 15 years. And just because he was such an encourager and he was such a believer in your talent and abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And he was always encouraging, not just me, everybody in the building about what they could do. And I remember reading something actually from a friend recently who, she is a writer and she writes all the time. And she pointed back recently to this high school teacher who told her, you're a great writer and like you can do this. Hmm. And that still is in her mind, motivating her to write to this day. And I think,
interesting.
I look back to some of those conversations when I was working at the radio station and my boss saying like, you got this, you got talent. And like,
nice.
You need to keep working at this, but like, I like what you're doing. And that goes a long way in helping foster someone's career. And if you can be that person, I think, to tell somebody that they're on the right path or that you like what they're doing, you never know how far those words of encouragement are going to go.
That's funny. Yeah. As you were saying that about your friend who's a writer, it made me think back to when I was in college. One of my professors, I was taking advertising classes. I remember her specifically talking about photography.
Yeah.
Because essentially we had to come up with our own little campaign. And she was like, hey, this is a pretty great concept. You know, the headline, like the copy is great, but these images are awesome. She's like, have you ever thought about photography? And thinking back, I realized that maybe that may have been what kind of pointed me in the direction of focusing more on photography as I got into graphic design.
Yeah.
It all always had a more photographic lean to it. And then obviously got into photography as well. And we are actually going to talk more about, you know, your history there at the radio station. I think I'm going to have a question maybe about the same boss who you mentioned, perhaps. But before we get to that, though, like before we get to that stage of your life, you know, I think like here on the show, you've only really just touched on the fact that like it wasn't all smooth sailing at home as a kid when it came to money. Do you want to share, you know, what I've heard you describe before as perhaps your most pivotal money moment?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think this is really when, if there is a inflection point in my personal finance trajectory, it was growing up, age basically 12 or 13, when my parents ended up filing for bankruptcy. And at the same time, after that, our car got repossessed. And it was just one of those things where we knew it was going to happen. We just didn't know when. And one day we were expecting it to happen and it didn't happen. And then it was gone. One morning. And it was one of those things where I just remember as a kid, it was kind of like looming over our heads.
Yeah.
And at the same time, money was a constant source of friction in the house. And So, yeah, I think I was also at this important age where it left this indelible mark on me, where it's
sure.
like my younger sister, she was a little bit younger than me, maybe couldn't, not quite old enough to realize exactly what was going on. My older sister was in high school. She was like dating and working. And I was just at this like hyper impressionable age where that left a major mark, and I think has probably still contributed to how I view money today, and just how intentional I am with it. But yeah, that was the point. It was that age, and it was those things happening in my family's life that made me say, like, you know what, I want to be good with money. You know what, I want to be good enough with money where I don't ever have to argue about money with my spouse. Mm-hmm. And it's not that, you know, Emily and I don't still have money disagreements from time to time, but it's one of those things where we don't want to get to the point where we're not sure if we're going to have enough, and that leads to conflict, or us having to do things that we don't want to do in order just to secure more money. But yeah, that's definitely probably the most pivotal point in my life when it comes to how I think and view and do money in personal finance.
Yeah, I mean, we always are going to have disagreements, oftentimes with our partners when it comes to money, but you just don't necessarily want all of your conversations to be negative, right? Like,
right.
Like hopefully you are in a position where you can sit down, and when you talk about money, it's a very good conversation.
Yeah.
It's this thing that where maybe you're cracking out, you know, a craft beer or a bottle of wine. You're having this meeting with your partner because you are wanting to look ahead at the different goals that you share or that you're, you know, that might be looming on the horizon. But, you know, I think it's hard to fully understand and know the impact of an event like that, like as we're growing up, even, you know, when decades have passed and we have the benefit of hindsight. Do you ever wonder, like, what would have happened if that repo had never happened? Do you think that maybe instead you would have been kind of like spendthrift Joel, like there would have been this alter ego,
honestly,
bizarro Joel,
probably.
Like, you think so?
Yeah, I think so. Wow. I mean, I don't really think about it like that very often, but I do think that left such a mark that I am a different person because of it.
You'd be a sneakerhead,
and I don't think. Yeah, maybe I would be one of those guys spending all his money on fancy sneakers.
You do spend more on shoes than I do. I'll say that.
Yes, but I also don't think of it as this negative experience that I would go back and change, even though at the time it was difficult. I feel like what it's led to has been something really good. And yeah, so I don't think of it as something that I want to go back and erase. But at the same time, that doesn't mean it was easy while it was happening.
Sure. It's not something that you would wish that you're planning to happen to your family,
yeah,
you know,
right.
to your kids. All right. So I feel like we've kind of covered young Joel. We're going to get to slightly older Joel. We're going to get to Joel as he entered adulthood. I've got several other questions, including a question about college, and we'll actually get to that right after this break. All right, so we are back. We're doing a special deep dive episode on Joel's money origin story. And Joel, you just shared the experience of having a family car repossessed. But ultimately, that wasn't a decision that you yourself made, right? It happened to you. You were kind of more in the passenger seat, not literally.
I was not the one who bought the car at
exactly.
12.
Exactly.
Yeah. I did not do the financing.
You were more in a passive position, I guess, is what I'm getting at here. But while you were in college, you actively made a decision that ended up having a lasting impact on your finances. Can you tell us about that?
Sure, yes. I mean, so while I was in college, the first 2 years, I ended up going to like a private school in South Carolina. And I think it was the best place for me at the time for the first 2 years of school. But it was one of those things where I realized halfway through, wait a second, I'm taking on debt to go to the school. I got a lot of great scholarships, but still, I was at 2 years into college.
A private school,
yeah,
cost a lot of money.
I had 12 grand in student debt, and probably a lot of people just laughed when they heard that because they're like, "That is nothing. That's like basically
12 grand, buddy.
Yeah.
Sure, that's like books for for me."
Exactly, and a lot of people would feel that way, and especially right now, I get it. Like the price of education has skyrocketed, of course, in the last 15, 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it's at the same time, for me, I said, why am I here? And can I accomplish the same goal, what I want? Can I get what I want at another school where maybe it's free? And the cool thing about the state of Georgia and a lot of other states have something similar. They have this thing called the Hope Scholarship, where if you had over a 3.0 GPA in high school, you were able to go to college for free in-state,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the in-state universities. And so I transferred back and ended up getting my last 2 years of education for free because of that. And I was living at home and working at the same time. So it was one of those things where I'm really glad I made that choice. Not adding more student loan pain to that bucket load of debt is something I'm happy I avoided.
Totally. And let's be honest, too, like there's a good chance of you not getting out in 2 more years. You probably would have been on that 5-year plan off of that private school.
No, it's interesting. Actually, switching back was one of those things where I lost a couple of credits. And so I had to work,
oh, really?
I had to work even harder. I'd already been taking like 18, 19 hours. And so mm-hmm. it kind of put me back on the track to like, all right, you still got to take 16, 17 hours every semester because okay. a couple of them didn't transfer, but it was still worth it.
Gotcha. Well, you know, like what I really appreciate though is the fact that like you were willing to make this serious change to your life. Like once you realize that things weren't panning out, because I believe that most college students in your position, I think they would have just stuck around and wrote it out while racking up that debt. I feel like that's what I would have done. Like, because at that point in your life, you're surrounded by friends. You see sort of the trajectory of everyone. And for me, like at one point, I thought about changing majors, and I knew that that was going to mean an additional year or two.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, no way. Like I can't do that. A, I didn't have the money on hand because I was running out of scholarship. But B, all my friends were graduating,
yep.
and so there was almost like this social pressure. And that's actually kind of surprising, I guess, because you are a very social dude. But even still, you're able to combat that. You're able to fight those pressures.
Well, a lot of my friends actually were seniors that year when I was graduating.
Well, there
so
you go.
They were leaving, and okay. I was like, I guess it's time. I mean, why not? Because yeah, when your friend base is leaving, you're right. That time kind of helps make that decision a little bit easier.
Got it.
But I will say, yeah, I think
you can't credit that fully. You were able to piggyback off of the fact that you had a bunch of friends who were graduating.
Yep.
You're like,
sure.
They're graduating. Time for me to get out of here too.
I'm gonna peace out as well. Yeah, for sure. And that was definitely part of it and made that decision easier. Yes. I think that's one of the things that, like you said, a lot of high school students, a lot of young adults going into college, first couple of years, they're oblivious to the student loan debt that they might be taking on. I think they're becoming less oblivious. I think it's become such a problem that they can't avoid knowing what's happening to them. But for a long time, a lot of people in, you know, just a little bit younger than we are have been kind of fed the belief that a college education at whatever cost is going to be worth it.
Mm-hmm.
And now people are being forced to challenge that assumption a little bit more. And I think it's a good thing because it's not that we think college is a bad thing. Like I would go over and do it again for myself.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you have to weigh the risk and the reward, and you have to say, do it in a responsible manner, because
yeah.
if you don't, it's not a good decision. And mm-hmm. you want to make sure that whatever education you're receiving is going to be put to good use, and that the debt, the potential debt load that you're taking on, that you minimize it, and that it propels you to higher earnings.
Nice. Yeah. And you also shared that you're saving money by living at home. I think that is such an underrated way to do college, right? Because like you said, those first 2 years, undergrads are oblivious. I mean, literally my first 2 years, I changed schools like within the college. Both, I mean, I did it literally, I think, every single year I was in college. I was in a different school because I thought, oh, first I'm going to be a science major. Oh, no, that I don't like chemistry. That's not working out. And so now I'm going to be in the business school. I'm in Terry. And then you bounce around. And I mean, those first 2 years, granted, some of those credits did count. But you have no idea what you're doing.
That's what those first 2 years are for, though.
Yes.
Some of that trial and error.
Absolutely.
And
but
figuring out what you're interested
but
in.
What better way to experience some of that trial and error than to be paying very little money
exactly.
by going to a local community college?
Yes.
We are huge proponents of folks doing that. So yeah, you graduated, you kind of, you know, started to grow up a little bit, move on with your life. Before we started our own little company here, you know, with this podcast, like I pictured you as what I'd call like a company man.
Not that you had, like, bad. Well,
you didn't have to wear like a suit or anything, right?
No, that's actually part of the reason and a terrible reason, but why I chose to go work in radio was because you could wear jeans and flip-flops. And literally, that was half of my reason.
Really?
Like, you don't have to dress up to do that.
I feel, yeah. Well, a lifestyle and what it feels like to go work for a company.
Totally.
That has a lot of weight when it comes to the decisions. I mean, literally, when I was looking to apply to different advertising agencies, like that was also something I kept in mind as well, because I can't remember if Mad Men was out at that point, but even still, the modern advertising agency, it was still kind of like a cooler place to work.
Yeah. You're like, if I can't drink an old fashioned on the job, I'm out of here.
Than like an accounting firm or something like that. But the ability to work in a creative department and just wear jeans and a hoodie was definitely something that was appealing to me. And so it's not fancy in that way, but your job specifically, like you had nice company benefits, like a 401k. Like I just joked earlier about how that's not something I ever had access to, but you did. You had a match. I've never had anything like that up until very recently here with our company. So my question for you, did you start investing did you start maxing out that 401k right away? Like, how did you know that that was a smart move to make? How did you learn what to do?
Sure. Yeah. No, I did not start maxing out right away. I knew.
You heard it, folks. When Joel first got his first job, he was not taking advantage of the company match.
No, I was getting the match.
Okay.
That was the one thing I knew not to screw up on.
There you go.
But only because literally the job that I, my first job that I got, or well, not my first job, but the second job that I got that I was at for 14, 15 years was, we talked a lot about personal finance. That was I worked on a consumer advice radio show. And so I knew enough to not miss out on the company match, but I had still not yet, my ears had not been perked up to the ideas of financial independence and the idea of like, well, okay, yeah, I'm going to get, if I save 10% for 45 years of my life, then I'll be able to retire. That was still kind of the way I was thinking at that point in life.
Kind of have that old school mindset.
Yeah, well, I will say, still. Plus my salary was minuscule at the time. So maxing it out was, I wouldn't have been able to live.
It wasn't an option.
No, it was like not even close to an option. So getting the match was enough of a sacrifice for me to be able to make. But later on, as like I got more in tune with what money can do if it's invested early enough, yeah, I did begin to pour more and more into my 401k, max out my Roth IRA, then eventually max out my 401k. So it's one of those things where I was like, yes, okay. But I wish somebody had challenged me to do that sooner, had said, you know what, the match is great, but you can do more. And so I think that's why I get excited, especially when we hear from younger How to Money listeners. And they're like,
dude,
I'm doing it already. And I'm like, man, if only
you have,
23, 24, I had that same information, that same challenge, that same knowledge that you have. Like I, you know, and part of it really is not just, I can't blame it on a lack of knowledge. It really was just a lack of intentionality. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the fact that they have all those things working together, yeah, I'm super impressed.
Well, I mean, I will say just reaching financial independence, it had a branding problem, basically.
True.
Right? And
That's true.
The past 10 years, it really has come a long way as being, you know, as folks seeing retirement as something that you do when once you hit 59 and a half or 65 years old, where you sit on the rocker on the front porch, you got the gold watch, you're sitting there, you no longer have to work. That has always been the view, typically, of retirement, of reaching a point of financial freedom. But over the past 10 years, we have seen a dramatic shift in what it means to be financially independent. It doesn't mean waiting until you're really old to completely pull the plug on working. It can mean gradually over time making that transition, taking on different jobs that you want, just the ability to have options.
Socking away enough so you can quit your day job and go do your own thing and start your own business. I mean, yeah, I think you're right. I think the nuance in the space has grown dramatically, and so many great voices have come up to say, like, no, you can go this path or you can go this path. And so it's opened up people's eyes to say, oh, wait, there are a lot of different directions I can go in. It's not just the one path that has kind of been the traditional. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, the traditional path. Exactly. Okay, so real quick, once you got that first decent paying job, what were you splurging on before craft beer, right? So on every interview, we bring guests on and we ask them what their craft beer equivalent is. What was your craft beer equivalent before craft beer?
I think it was probably baseball games. I was going to Braves games a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where, again, I didn't have much money, especially in those early working years. And I was able to score Braves tickets for super cheap because they played downtown. Almost nobody went to the games. I could ride my bike over there.
Yeah.
And I would go to games and get out of there for $5 or $10 if I bought some food. I mean, there was just all these ways to go to Braves games for super cheap that don't exist now. And so I feel like it's like a
but you weren't
relic
splurging.
From an old time.
Right, right. So you weren't spending money on it. Was there something
But I was
else?
Going consistently,
okay.
Right? So I would
a
go
small
to-
small purchase done consistently adds up.
I would go 20, 25 games a year.
Wow.
And those were good old days. Now I make it to one, maybe two. I did make it to the World Series, of course, like I told everybody.
That's right. And you didn't, I guess we haven't talked about this yet on the show. You scored yourself some of that World Series swag.
I got a shirt for
some of that merch
for Christmas, yes. But yeah, that was kind of what I viewed as my splurge for the time. I was like, I'm going to go to as many Braves games as I want.
You're the Braves game guy.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Okay, so you've kind of alluded to this. Many folks know Clark Howard. You know, he was a nationally syndicated consumer advocate radio host. And like you said, he talks a lot about personal finance. And so I'm assuming you learned a ton while working on a show. There's a lot of different concepts, a lot of different principles that I'm sure you heard reiterated on the show constantly. So my question for you, though, is like, do you have any specific lessons that you learned, like not necessarily from the show, but just from being around Clark Howard himself, that you different lessons that you picked up from observing him in real life?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And by the way, the person I was talking about earlier on, the boss who influenced me, was not Clark.
Oh, really?
It was actually the program director, Pete Spriggs, who was it still is a phenomenal human being. But
there you go.
I could have said many of the same things about Clark, truly. And yes.
Shout out to Pete.
Yeah, Pete's awesome. Miss that guy. But Clark is such a generous guy, and in every sense of the word. And he's like this positive influence, I would say, on everybody that he meets, like random people at Costco, the way he treats them, or just people, somebody on the street, somebody has a flat tire. Like, he's the kind of guy who stops to help change it. Like,
that's awesome.
That's rare, especially in today's day.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, I think what I learned from Clark was the way you treat everybody matters, and down to the person who's checking out your groceries at the grocery store, or the waitress or waiter when you're ordering food. And so, I don't know, I think that goes a long way. He was just this like incredible cocktail of like optimism, kindness, and humility. And it just kind of, it's infectious. It makes you want to live in the same way, and he's definitely that kind of guy. He's one impressive dude.
Well, especially considering, I mean, we had him on the show here last year. We can link to that episode in our show notes. But we talked about how he sold his first business when he was very young.
Right.
He was financially independent at a very young age. And so you could easily see him going in a direction that wouldn't lend itself to being charitable, not only with your money, but also how you treat other people.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so on that note, we're going to take a quick break. But after that, speaking of financial independence, we're going to talk a little bit more about that. We're going to talk about real estate. We'll get to all of that right after this break. All right, we're back from the break. We're going to wrap this thing up here before long.
Yeah, kick me out of here.
I got somewhere to be, buddy. I got somebody else to talk to. Yeah, no, literally nobody else to talk to today. Just some episodes to edit and listen to. But let's talk about real estate specifically, because I honestly can't remember how it is that you got interested in investing in real estate. I know my story. We talked about this last week. I remember how I had, you know, the seeds of real estate planted, but I don't know how that came about for you. So can you share, you know, how it is that you first saw the light when it came to real estate?
Okay, so this is gonna probably sound a little lame, but my my mom, super big into HGTV.
Okay.
Loves HGTV. Like, she is probably Joanna Gaines's biggest fan.
She is.
And
her and your dad, they didn't they go to Texas?
They went to Waco.
And they specifically stayed in a property that she had renovated.
Yes.
Was that on, like, was it an Airbnb?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Yes.
I bet that thing rakes in the cash.
Yeah. And she's not like stalker level, but if she met her in person, I think she might faint. She'd be that excited.
She would definitely recognize her on the street.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. Uh-huh. But she'd probably, I don't know, she'd probably play it cool. She probably would. But
just start sweating. Gotta play it cool.
But for me, I would say HGTV, not my favorite channel. But there was this one show that would come on. And
Flip or Flop or something?
Like that? No, it was called Income Property.
Okay.
And it was this host, Scott McGillivray.
I don't remember that one.
Okay, so this guy used to help people with their property, turn it into, like he would help them renovate it and turn it into a property that would cash flow even more. And sometimes he would turn a single family home into a duplex, or he would turn a duplex into a nicer duplex, or there were all these different ways he would suggest to make over your house in order to make it more cash flow positive and help it to make more money and be more valuable.
I like it.
And I remember watching that show and I was like, okay, so it's not just like paint on walls and QTing something up. Like, he's got this plan, and you would always see the numbers at the end, and people would be raking in more rent than he even assumed at the beginning, so that he'd be like, all right, if you do this into this duplex, you get $1,200 on each side. And at the end of the day, they're getting $1,400 on each side. And I was like, what? How are they? They're killing it.
Nice.
And I think that sparked the seed of like, wow, okay, you can create something beautiful for somebody to live in, and you can make money at the same time. Mm-hmm. And there were certainly other touch points along the way. I mean, I think getting into the Bigger Pockets podcast for a while, which is still a great one if you want to begin investing in real estate. It's really, definitely one of the best ones.
It's tops.
That, I would say, though, kind of sparked the beginning where I was like, oh, okay, my mind started turning.
Scott, was that his name?
Yeah.
Scott G or J, I don't know. So he was the one that was like switching out, swapping out the garage door before it was cool. But before all the other publications had written about the fact that this one thing will increase the curb appeal
right.
and allow your property to return more.
Yeah,
every single month.
He was super smart. He always did a good job with those renos and he really offered a lot of good advice. And then he would do a lot of the work because he was also a contractor and they were always just fun episodes. I don't think that show's on anymore. It was one of those where if you went back to the backlogs and watched them, you would learn a lot.
Got it. And so, yes, I mean, so you've been investing in real estate for a while now. At this point, I feel like you have a lot on your plate. You've got several properties that you yourself manage. You don't pay for management. You don't, you know, that's for the birds. You're getting all that money. You're keeping those expenses at a minimum. But you're also, you're wrapping up, renovating your home. You've got this, you know, the podcast. It's a full-time job. You've got three kids. Do you foresee yourself continuing to buy additional properties? Where's your head at as far as your investment property portfolio moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think I do see myself buying more properties, but I also see myself going towards maybe easier ways to use the assets that I have or the money that I'm making to make investments because, yeah, like we've talked about on the show, we love investment properties and they have been great for us. They've been great for me and my family to grow our net worth, to have monthly cash flow. And I love that they're right around the corner from us and many of which we have lived in before. And so there's like this cool element to investing where you live. And I love that. I love that part of it. And I could see myself potentially buying more properties. But like you said, like, yeah, plates kind of fold these days. And if we want to grow this business, then growing the rental property business kind of takes a back seat. It's on the back burner. And so I think if I did want to do that, if I did want to go hard in that direction, I would have to find some help when it comes on the property management side.
Yeah. And I was going to actually suggest that because I just kind of knocked it. But like, that's the path that you go. I mean, you get to a certain point and
there's a certain scale at which you can't handle it all yourself.
Exactly. And it does feel like it makes a little bit more sense to have a manager, a management company, or an individual who knows you, how it is that you like things to be maintained, the different kind of vendors who you'd like to choose. And if you've got somebody on your side who's got your back like that, I can see that being incredibly valuable when it comes to freeing up your time.
So yeah, maybe, but there's something I love about physical real estate. And I think it's a fun investment in a lot of ways. There's so many perks. We've talked about them way too much on the show. And there's older episodes you can go to dig into why we love it so much. But there's also just this tangible element that I like about it, whereas numbers on a screen have a different effect.
They don't do it for you as much. Huh?
Not the same, right? Like a 401k balance or IRA. Like it's exciting to see those things grow, but I think it's more exciting for me to buy a property that I'm like, oh, this is undervalued. And I can, like it's that Scott McGillivray sort of mindset where it's like, how can I maximize the returns on this piece of land here with this little house on it?
Yeah.
And I just love old houses too. Yeah. I love those 1920s and 30s houses. And that's kind of
they've got that character.
Yeah. And so I'm like, I always get excited to go over and take a look at a house because they're pretty, they're cool. It's different than sticking your $6,000 in a Roth. That's not a bad idea.
You need to do that. don't hear Joel incorrectly.
Right.
Definitely do that. Make that a priority, I would say, before you start dabbling into real estate, of course.
And not everybody feels the same way I do about houses or about real estate. And a lot of people think of it as a pain or this thing to maintain. And I'm like, well, no, I think of it as this thing that you can make better, make prettier, and invite people to live in.
Improve the community.
Yeah. And so part of it maybe is a mindset or maybe just a predisposition. I don't know.
Yeah. So you're talking about the difference between tangible assets and intangible. So it sounds like you're less of an NFT guy, more of a Masterworks kind of guy.
Even that, like I'm like, if I don't get to put it in my house, I would rather, if I'm going to buy a piece of art, which I do.
Buy it locally.
I love art.
Yeah.
I buy the local art, I put it in my house.
Get it
if for some
walls.
Reason that art like quintuples in value, cool. But I don't care really.
Yeah. It also doesn't surprise me that you're into real estate because I feel like art, do you find yourself attracted to the aspect that you get to meet new people? So, you know, it depends on how busy your life is. But when you show a property, it can either be the most, in my mind, in my experience, it can either be the most fun thing ever, or it can be the most stressful thing. Because if your calendar is pretty open, maybe the previous tenants got out of there a little bit sooner, you've already gotten the place cleaned, it's good to go. You feel good showing it, right? Like you've got time on your side, you've got folks lined up, and you're able to talk to them. You kind of get to hear their story a little bit. But then other times, I don't know, if you're you know, if there's a very narrow window and you've got to show it to 20 people, 30 people just in a single weekend.
That's a good point, yeah.
That can be stressful. But I'm thinking about your first job there at the Eckerd's or whatever, the photo development drugstore. There's an element of interacting with people that I could see you kind of getting into, just kind of being there in person, getting to hear their story.
Exactly. I think that's part of what I like about real estate too is, yeah, even when you have to get contractors in there or something, if you get people you trust, like I love meeting my dude Edwin at the house and talking, like he's a great guy. And so every time...
He's a good dude.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. I got to put a new bathtub in a place or something like that. Like, I get to say hi to him. And so...
Your most recent work that you did at a rental? Some fresh, new bathtub, new tile.
New tile, yeah, exactly. And so those are the kind of things where I think that relational aspect, that bouncing around town and getting out of the house, like that stuff kind of... it's a lot of fun in my book.
Yeah. So kind of on that note, we talk a decent bit here on the show about financial independence. We just talked about it here a little bit. We talk about financial freedom. We've shared how we've essentially reached Coast Fire. And so what advice would you give to anyone who is really pursuing financial independence? They're really getting after it. Do you have any specific thoughts to share with folks?
I guess when you phrase it that way, probably my initial reaction is to... make sure you're doing it in a sustainable way.
Was that a biased question, the way I asked
No. I think like...
For the idiots out there who all they care about is money and they're just trying to hit their numbers.
If somebody is already overdoing it, then you probably need to cool your jets a little bit. And overdoing it is a specific thing, right? But there are a lot of ways to accomplish the goals that you want without burning out in the midst of accomplishing those goals. And I think there's something to be said for slowing down and doing it in a methodical way. Because if your savings rate is 70%, well, what if it was 55% and you got to enjoy your life a little bit more? And maybe you weren't working your fingers to the bone, and maybe you got to spend more time with people that you loved, and you got to take an extra week off. I mean, those are the kind of things where going back to what I said about sneakers, it's all a trade-off. And you can buy those sneakers now. I'm not suggesting that you should. I'm just saying, like, there are measured trade-offs that are worth making even in the here and now. And that's exactly what we try to bring to the show every week, right? Is saying, like, we drink a fancy beer because it adds a lot to our life, and it costs more money than most people are willing to pay. Mm-hmm. But we have just a few areas of our lives where we do that. And I think there are some people who... in the dogged pursuit of financial independence are not letting themselves enjoy almost anything.
Right.
And I think that's a tough position to be in. I would say don't do stuff that you hate longer than you need to just for money. But at the same time, we are also pro financial independence. We are pro that pursuit.
Yep.
And so it is this balance that you have to strike. And
so
I think,
hard to strike that balance.
Yeah. The loudest voices are the extremes. And they're the ones telling you, like, go all the way, go all out, and you can do this in 5 years or less. And then there are the other people who are like, go the slow methodical route. And if you just invest, 7-8% a year, you'll be able to retire when you're 45. And we're saying, and it's not a super sexy message, but that there is an awesome place in the in-between where you can live the way you want to in a lot of ways now, while paying a lot of attention to your money and how you invest, so that you can set yourself up for success in a few years from now, and then for a lot of success, a decade or two from now.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I think we've got a lot of listeners who are all across the spectrum when it comes to where they are in their pursuit of financial independence and their pursuit of being really smart with their money. But I think there's a sort of a real danger or a real temptation to look at what the world is feeding you and telling you that you should do, which is oftentimes the pursuit of money, success, power, the different things, achievement, right? Generally speaking, whether it be the boss at work who is a great boss and who is encouraging you, like we talked about earlier. It's like, oh, you're such a great writer. And while that may have initially just been kind of a pat on the back or just them truly calling out a talent that they see, that can easily find its way being channeled into working more and neglecting some of the other important things in life. I feel like money, just generally speaking, is, it's almost like this, like it's the sirens, like Odysseus, he's tying himself to the mast, and the sirens, the call of that money, it will always be there. And I believe that there are fewer folks saying, be careful of that, as opposed to the voices, the books, the podcasts that are out there. Who are telling folks,
and we're saying, you need
this
some earplugs.
Is what you need to do. Just go hard after it. And then once you achieve that, you're going to have options. You're going to have success. You're going to have happiness. But we believe here that you've got to strike that balance. And it is, I think it's going to be easier for you to maintain that balance as you, you know, climb the ladder of success, rather than having it be completely lopsided. You climb the ladder and then expect to be able to kind of find that balancing act while you're way up there on the ladder. I think it's a lot easier to find that balance when you're closer to the ground. But I like what you said. I mean, it truly is. It's difficult because it depends on the individual. It depends where they are in their life.
Exactly.
It depends what they have going on, their interests, all of that you have to take into account.
When you and I were 24, 25, we were willing to make more sacrifices with our time in order to make more money so that we could invest it to make progress for our futures. And now, you know, a lot of the hard work has been done. And it's not that there isn't a lot of hard work, fun work left to do, but it is one of those things where, yeah, so much of it does depend on your life stage. Do you have kids? Like we talked to, you know, I don't know, just what you just said made me think of multiple episodes we've done, multiple interviews that we've done. One with Wes Moss about happiness and how you can't just turn the dial on and off. And basically, like, yeah, the things that you're pursuing in the here and now are the hobbies, the relationships are crucial. And you can't cut those off and then expect when you hit retirement, where are my friends at? And then I'm thinking about Carl, our interview with Mr. 1500, and how he's talking about how you shouldn't do live-in flips when you have kids. And maybe some people are willing to do that. But like, it is, there's like a time and a place for everything. And it's not one size fits all, that's for sure.
Exactly. Well, speaking of core pursuits, as Wes Moss likes to call them, different hobbies, let's get to our beer this episode, which is called Woodland Pursuit. And I completely 100% picked up this beer for us here on the show, specifically for you, because it's got a disc golf goal. Is that what you call them? Goals? Like the metal basket? The hole, I guess? I don't know.
Yeah, the holes. Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Disc golf. But it's got that. It's got a little red putter sitting in there. And it's in the woods. It's called Woodland Pursuit, which also, Woodland happens to be the name of the street that you live on.
True.
Our streets intersect. So you've got Woodland, you've got Delaware. This is a juicy New England IPA by one of our favorite breweries, Humble Forger. What were your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, when I first saw this beer, I was like, oh my gosh, this is like my spirit animal beer. It really is. Because yeah, the disc golf, the Woodland, which is the name of my street.
It's perfect.
A street that I love. And yeah, this was awesome beer, Matt. This is delicious. And you know, it's funny because for an IPA, it had a lot of like fruit flavor, but not generic fruit, like specifically like peach and apricot, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I would say, I think it's, this brewery does a lot of great fruited beers, but there is no fruit in this beer. It's all the hops.
It's all hops. I literally am going to do a deep dive on this after we hit stop on this episode, because I almost can't believe that there's not actually fruit in here. But on the label, it only has hops listed out. It's a New Zealand juicy IPA.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're New Zealand hops, I guess. I wonder if the New Zealand hops have like special flavor varieties that we can't get here in the States.
Can you go to New Zealand and just like eat the hops right off the vine and it's like you're eating an apricot or something? I don't know.
I want to, although I don't think they'll let us in. But
yeah, that's true. You
know, but yeah,
couple more weeks.
This beer is so stinking good, so delicious, so satisfying. And I feel like, yeah, this is now on my top favorites list.
It's the perfect balance between sweet and the bitterness that you get from the hops. There's so much juice, but it doesn't get too sweet. Like as soon as you taste it, you think, oh, this is going to be too sweet. But then it kind of like drops off and it switches to kind of like that hoppy bitterness. And so they've somehow struck the perfect balance. This is one of the best, certainly the best beer we've had all year. Well, shoot. Yeah, we just had Trillium actually. So maybe we've had some awesome beers.
It's right up there with them.
It really is. So yeah, if you happen to see this one in your local bottle shop, Woodland Pursuit by Humble Forger, we would highly recommend that you pick this one up. It's fantastic. But Joel, that's going to be it, buddy, for this episode. Listeners can find our show notes up on our website at howtomoney.com.
That's right. And next Wednesday, we'll resume kind of more of our normal format.
Yeah. That's right.
Doing a deep dive on a specific personal finance topic.
We can only interview each other so many times.
Well, I don't know. We could do it on a repeat.
We did it twice.
Groundhog Day style.
That'll be it.
All right. Well, that's going to do it, Matt. Until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.